In June, today, it's a great pleasure to have Alberto Sassana to give the talk. And Alberto, I guess, he will talk about the massive black hole binaries, the evolution dynamics, and the gravitational wave that's going to be detected by LISA. Okay, so Alberto, please take it away.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the invitation. Of course, I mean it's would be much nicer to be there, but yeah, well, let's get it work also remotely. Yeah, today I would like to tell you a little bit about massive black hole binaries from a, mostly from an astrophysical perspective. So essentially why they're interesting, how they form, how they evolve, and of course also from the gravitational wave side. When we talk about gravitational waves and massive black hole binaries, obviously we talk about LISA and about pulsar timing. So these are the essentially the missions and the observatories I'm most heavily involved with. But today I will just talk a little bit about LISA, mostly about LISA. If you want to hear more about pulsar timing, I can come back another time. So the plan of the talk is essentially, as I said, I will tell a little bit about the hierarchical formation of structures and massive black holes in particular, and then I will focus quite a bit on the dynamics of these objects because it's I think it's very interesting and still, poorly understood to some extent, and it has a huge implications in terms of gravitational wave observations, as I will said afterwards. And then we talk a little bit about observational prospects with LISA and perhaps some prospects to do multi-messenger astronomy also with the electromagnetic emission that we expect from those systems. All right, so let's get started with some observational fact. As you all know, well, essentially every time we had the capability to sorry, maybe just take this out. I don't know why I have the power to admit people, apparently. Anyway, every time we had the capability to resolve the central region of a galaxy, we always found a massive compact object in the center that we identify with massive black hole. And now we have pretty clear evidence that those systems are massive black holes, especially after the very nice pictures that were taken by the Event Horizon Telescope of M87 and Sagittarius A star. And we know that massive black holes are the central engine of quasars, right? Which are just essentially black holes eating gas and shining at very high luminosities. And those quasars are already in place, some of them at very high redshift. So one of the most interesting
Sorry, can I
areas.
ask you a question?
Sure.
So what difference between massive black holes and supermassive black holes, or do you use them?
Nomenclature. I mean, I think it's really, I don't have a real good answer to that. Some, people usually talk about supermassive black hole when they really get to, the quasars, like the 10 to the 9 solar masses and massive black holes down to 10 to the 6. But really they're just interchangeable. I mean, anything, from 10 to the 5 and beyond, you can call it massive black hole or supermassive black hole.
Okay.
There's no clear distinction there.
No difference. Okay. Thank
Yeah.
you.
And so so it's interesting to understand how these objects form and evolve. And of course, since galaxies merge and they host massive black holes in their center, of course, the prospect of detecting gravitational waves with massive black hole binaries is of course a very interesting one. So as I said, we see massive black holes at the center of galaxies. This is just a random, collection of pictures from the internet, right? You see here, jets shouting out from this galaxy at the center when there is this accreting object with an obscuring torus behind it. This is, the jet of M87 here. This is an FR2 galaxy. You see these huge lobes that extend out to, megaparsecs. So there's clearly a massive object at the center here doing a lot of stuff. So we, since decades, essentially, we have a lot of evidence that, massive black holes are essentially doing two things. They are eating a lot, of gas, right? And they are, you know, ejecting also a lot of matter, right? Producing jets. So you see also here the orientation of the jet is pretty accurate. And how these things, how these objects come about? Okay, the formation of massive black hole, of course, is framed in the formation, in the hierarchical formation structures. And as you all know, the best model that we have so far to describe the evolution of the universe is the Lambda CDM model, where essentially, you know, small structures, small dark matter perturbation grow in mass with time, and they, you know, the baryons are collected at the center of this formation, they form protogalaxies and so on and so forth. So as I said, essentially you start from this fluctuation of dark matter, and this fluctuation grows in time, and they start to collapse and to form dark matter halos. And if you take a Lambda CDM universe, so where the dark matter is cold, the first structures that form are actually small structures. And what you see in this graph here is the distribution of dark matter halo mass at different redshift. Okay, so you see at redshift 20, you essentially are dominated by very, very small halos. And as you progress in redshift, bigger and bigger halos start to form. Okay, and these halos are, you know, they're forming just because of merger of smaller halos into bigger halos and accretion of dark matter from the ambient. And this is essentially, as I just said, the hierarchical clustering paradigm, where, you know, big halos that we see today, they form from, you know, smaller halo merging together and accreting dark matter from the diffused ambient. Of course, this is for the dark matter halo, but what we are, you know, what we usually see in the universe are baryons, right? So what happened to the baryons? Well, baryons in the early universe are essentially atomic or molecular hydrogen mostly. And then of course, a fraction of helium. And essentially what the baryons do at the beginning is not much, right? They just, if they cannot, as long as baryons cannot cool, they just follow the dark matter, the gravitational potential that the dark matter halos are, you know, preparing for them. Because I forgot to say, but dark matter is 10 times more abundant in our current paradigm than baryons, right? So these baryons sit at the center of this dark matter halo until the dark matter halo becomes massive enough and there is enough baryons in it that, you know, the virial temperature of the halo is so high that baryons can start to cool. And this, of course, and the cooling mechanism, the cooling process is different depending on what is the fraction of molecular hydrogen that you have available. Because molecular hydrogen, as you see in this cooling function here on the left, can start to efficiently cooling at, you know, around 1,000 or a couple of thousand Kelvin, whereas atomic hydrogen, you know, needs about 10 to the 4 Kelvin to cool. And of course, the bigger the halo, the higher the virial temperature. So a consequence of this is that if you have enough molecular hydrogen available, you can start to cool baryons in smaller halos. So you cool smaller amount of baryon and you form essentially smaller self-gravitating objects. Whereas if you, for some reason, you don't have H2 available, you have to rely on hydrogen cooling, and that needs a bigger mass. So what you're gonna form are collapsed self-gravitating more massive objects. Now, and this essentially, this distinction defines the different routes that we have that people have identified to form the first massive stars and also the first black holes, okay? Now, one thing that I should say is that, of course, I'm talking about hydrogen cooling because, you know, in the early universe, we don't have metals essentially, or, you know, very negligible fraction of metals. And a consequence of this is that cooling is a very slow process, is a fairly inefficient process. And so what you form are, you know, bigger, big objects. So if you have hydrogen cooling, molecular hydrogen cooling, generally you can collapse into big stars of the order of hundreds, maybe up to 1,000 solar mass. And these are the so-called population three stars. And these, it is expected that these massive stars will end their life into intermediate mass black hole of perhaps, you know, a couple of 100, 300, 400 solar masses. And this might be a route to form the seeds of the massive black holes that we see today in galaxies, right? So you can think that in the first mini halos, the Tyr redshift, you can form a population of intermediate mass black holes. If you cannot rely on molecular hydrogen cooling, so you have to wait for a longer time, and so you accumulate more gas, and then what you can form in the center of these halos are essentially protogalactic disks, gaseous disks, that can go global instabilities that funnel the gas toward the center, forming a massive central object that can be a supermassive stars or a quasi star. So there is all zoology of models there. But the net outcome of those type of models is that if the accretion rate, so that the gas that you can funnel to the center is high enough, then you can end up forming perhaps an object of 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 solar masses at the center directly, then can directly collapse into a much more massive intermediate mass black hole of the order of, say, you know, tens of thousands of solar masses. Okay, so these are, let's see, the two extreme, let's say, for the formation of these first black holes, let's say intermediate mass black hole at high redshift. And in between, there is a whole, you know, there are different shades of gray, if you want, right? For example, you can form clusters of massive stars that merge together, forming an intermediate mass black hole right away that is somewhere in between 100 and several thousand solar masses. So there is a whole, you know, zoology of models. But let's say historically, there has been a distinction between, you know, low mass seeds, so POP3 models that rely mostly on molecular hydrogen cooling, and direct collapse black hole or high heavy seed models that essentially rely on atomic hydrogen cooling. Okay. And in the, you know, this, what I show you here is the mass function that come out of, you know, some models for the formation of these seeds. So on the very, on the right, in red, you see, you know, distribution of masses of the seed black holes in the POP3 scenario. So you see it's between 100 and 1,000 solar masses, whereas on the right, you see what happens in a direct collapse scenario where, you know, you might expect this distribution to be peaked around, you know, 10 to the 5 solar masses or so. So theoretically, we have models to produce, you know, seed black holes in small halos at high redshift. What happens next? Well, is, you know, hierarchical clustering happens, right? So here is a cool movie that I just took from Illustris, and what you see here is on the left you see the stellar component, and on the right you see the gas component, and what you see here is essentially a zoom in of a small volume of the simulation that correspond to a galaxy cluster. So, and, you know, the visualization flies around, but what you see here is that these galaxies, you know, move around, of course, in the overall potential of dark matter. If you look at the gas, you see that galaxies are really connected by gas stream and they accrete gas from filaments. But if you look at the star, you see that, you know, as the galaxies are driven to the center of the potential wedge, they will start to merge with each other quite often. And especially here now, you will see a lot of these mergers. So one is coming right now, there, ole, flying by, and voila. And then another one, and then another one that are coming. And this is essentially a simulation that shows the formation of a giant elliptical, the brightest cluster galaxy at the center of a galaxy cluster. This can be, for example, M87. Okay, so you see that there is, you know, a lot of gas dynamics going on, and there is a lot of, you know, mergers. And in fact, our understanding of how the massive black holes grow after you know, the seeds are formed is essentially a combination of these two processes, right? Since galaxies merge together, right, and there are these black holes at the center, of course, it is expected that during galaxy mergers, these black holes will also form black hole binaries, and these black hole binaries will potentially merge and be powerful gravitational resources. And of course, along this process, of course, because of several instabilities that can be triggered by internal dynamics of the galaxy, but also by mergers, cold gas can flow into the center of the galaxy, and then the black holes can accrete and shine as quasars. So the black holes can grow in mass because, of course, gas accretion, and also by merging with other objects, with other massive black holes. Of course, all of these is, you know, is a general theoretical picture, but the details are you know, very blurry, right? Because of course we don't have a predictive model for where and how the first seeds form. So I told you about two possibilities, but you know, the fine details are essentially unknown. We don't know much about their growth along the cosmic history. For example, you might know that, you know, there are very massive quasars shining already at redshift 7, and it's not quite clear how they accreted their mass so quickly, for example. And so, you know, there's a lot of you know, open questions to answer here. So let me talk a little bit about the evolution then of these objects. So the first process that I'm just, you know, flashing the slide about is gas accretion. Right, so black holes can efficiently accrete gas, right? And if you take like just a vanilla calculation for a standard accretion disk, and you compute how much rest mass you can convert into energy, so the accretion efficiency, you can compute the Eddington luminosity, which is, you know, with some assumption the theoretical limit to which a black hole can accrete. And from that, you can actually derive a simple scaling for the evolution of black holes that is an exponential growth. Okay, so by accretion, black holes can grow their mass exponentially. And in fact, we know, or we have a good, let's say, we have good factual evidence, observational evidence, that most of the black hole mass, of the massive black hole mass, has been accreted along the cosmic history via efficient accretion of gas. And this is the famous Soltan argument, where, because, you know, we see quasars, and so from the energy output of the quasar, we can convert that energy output into the mass that has been accreted by the black hole, right? And compare that mass to the actual mass of the massive black holes that we see today in the universe. And the two measurements, the two estimates match quite fairly well. So most of the mass of the, you know, million to billion solar mass black holes that we see today in the universe has been likely accreted via efficient accretion of gas. However, this doesn't necessarily mean that mergers are irrelevant. They might not be the most important mean of mass growth of the black hole, but to some extent they will inevitably happen in a hierarchical universe. And in fact, we have a lot of evidence of galaxy merging, right? If you just look at the sky with our telescope, we see plenty of galaxies that are interacting with each other in the process of merging. So this is the famous antenna galaxy here. The two galaxies that are essentially undergoing a second flyby, a second encounter, because you see these tidal tails that have developed already in the first encounter that they had. And it's interesting to understand what happens to the massive black holes when two galaxies merge. Because of course, you know, it's not that when two galaxies merge, the two black holes are teleported to the center of the galaxy, right? At the beginning, they will lurk somewhere in the outskirts of the, you know, merger remnant. And then they have a long way to go before meeting each other to the center. And this is what I'm showing in this, it's essentially a cartoon here. where on the x-axis you have, you know, a typical scale of separation from kiloparsecs down to milliparsecs here. And on the y-axis, I plot the so-called residence time, which is essentially the time that is that two, let's say, two black holes finding themselves in a merger remnant spend at any given separation. So at the start of the merger, the two black holes will be somewhere in the outskirts of the galaxy. So the relative separation will be of several kiloparsecs. And in order to get to, you know, become gravitational wave emitter, they have, you know, to get close to each other. And there are physical mechanisms that are efficient to do so. On large scales, the first one is the tax on large scale is dynamical friction. And dynamical friction is essentially the collective gravitational pull of light objects onto a massive intruder, essentially. And you can think about dynamical friction in this term. You have a massive object that is moving in a sea of light objects, right? And the massive object focuses the light objects behind its trajectory, and this produces a gravitational pull that slows it down. And by slowing it down, it makes it fall to the center. So this massive object that is, you know, in the outskirts of this big galaxy would do something like this. Okay, we'll end up in spiraling and get to the center of the galaxy because of this dynamical friction process. And you know, you don't have to trust my drawing here. There's plenty of numerical simulation, both in stellar background, like shown in the top here, and in gaseous background that show that the efficiency of this mechanism. So in general, dynamical friction is a pretty efficient mechanism to bring a massive objects from the outskirts of you know, a galaxy down to the center. However, at some point, dynamical friction becomes inefficient. And this is because when the two black holes see each other at the center of the galaxy, they start to feel each other pull, they bind into a binary, and they essentially respond to the stellar and gaseous background as a single object. So at this point, dynamical friction is not anymore a perturbation acting on a single object, but is essentially acting on the binary as a whole. And the main result of this is that it results in a perturbation of the center of mass of the binary, but it becomes inefficient in bringing the two objects close together. And this, you know, if there wasn't any other physical mechanism at work, this would cause a binary to stall. Because of course, the two black holes start to see each other essentially when the mass enclosed in their orbit is of the order of their own mass. And for typical massive black holes in typical galactic background, these happen at scales that are of the order of parsecs, okay? And of course, as you probably all know, the gravitational waves, the efficiency of emission of gravitational wave is a strong function of the separation of the two objects. And at parsec separation, two massive black holes would coalesce because of gravitational wave emission in several Hubble times, where several means like, you know, 10 to the 10, 10 to the 15 Hubble times, okay? And therefore, since dynamical friction become inefficient at this case, you have to find something to bring the two black holes together. And this has been known in the literature as the final parsec problem. So you need to bridge the gap between parsec and milliparsec separation in order for the two black holes, massive black holes to coalesce. How can you do that? Well, of course, there are other physical mechanisms at work because galaxy centers are very crowded places. And therefore this binary can still interact with its environment that is composed by gas and stars. And these two, let's say, type of interaction has been generally treated separately because, you know, we can barely do gas stars alone. We cannot even do gas alone so well. Imagine doing them together. So okay, we are still, you know, we are not there yet. Talking about stars, this is collisional dynamics. You can just solve brute force Newtonian equations using an embodied integrator, And what happens is that essentially you find that the slingshot mechanism is very efficient in this case, because you have now a bound binary here. You have an intruding star. The star, of course, all the energy here is owned by the binary. And the chaotic interaction between the binary and the star will tend to give energy to the star. So the net outcome, statistically, the net outcome of this interaction is going to be that the star makes a complex interaction with the binary, and it's ejected with a kinetic energy that is generally much higher than the kinetic energy that it had when it flew in. And so, with one star, you don't do much, but, star after star, you take away a lot of energy and angular momentum for the binary, and the binary shrinks. So this mechanism is known as the slingshot mechanism, and has been shown to be very efficient in extracting energy and angular momentum from the binary. And now forget about everything here, because I don't have time to go through the details, but for typical stellar backgrounds in typical galaxies that can be interesting for LISA, the shrinking slingshot of stars can bring binaries together in less than a giga year to a stage where gravitational wave emission takes over and bring them to the final coalescence. Of course, a giga year, it's still a pretty long time. The other thing that can happen is that binaries can interact with cold gas. You remember when two galaxies merge, cold gas can be funneled in the center. And because it's funneled, it's not funneled with zero angular momentum, in general, what it does, it forms a massive circumbinary disk around the binary. And the interaction between binary and circumbinary disk has been investigated, by many authors. And the original idea is essentially the following. You have mass that is in flowing in a disk with a given m dot. Okay, so you can compute what is the angular momentum that is in flowing in the disk. The binary carves a cavity in the disk. So it's a sort of angular momentum dam that keep the gas outside, at a certain separation. So essentially the angular momentum that the binary is injecting in the disk has to be equal to the dl in the t of the disk, right? In order to keep the gas at that separation. And if this is a very simple equation to solve. And if you do the calculation, you essentially find that the binary, the extraction of angular momentum from the binary is such that, if you put as much gas in the disk, right, as the reduced mass of the binary, right, here, you make essentially a factor of three step in separation. Okay, you shrink the binary by a factor of three. So, in principle, you can make 3 or 4-fold in, by accreting a mass comparable to the mass of, by putting in the disk a mass comparable to the mass of the binary, and that would be enough to shrink the binary to a gravitational wave emission stage. So this is all. Yes?
So here you're suggesting the angular momentum is taking away because of the accretion.
The cartoon here is not actually appropriate, so there shouldn't be an inflow here. So yeah, I'm just suggesting that since the binary opens the cavity, so it holds the gas, right? The binary is injecting angular momentum in the disk in order to keep the gas there, and so it shrinks. So that's the.
So it's a generating density wave that carries away angular momentum, or I'm just looking at this formula, right? Like a dl dt.
Yes.
Which is minus m dot this guy. So it seems if m dot is zero, your dl dt is zero.
The m dot is just the, this is a very, I'm going to get to the more physical, situation. This is a very, vanilla, let's say estimate, right? So m dot is just the mass flow in the disk. It's not the accretion of the black hole. Is that suppose you have an m dot that is constant throughout the disk, and at some point you have a quadrupolar torque of the binary that stops the gas at a given separation. Okay, so there is no in this That's why I thought about gas that you inject in the disk and not gas that is accreted by the binary, because there is no accretion on the binary in this scenario. But of course, you might argue that, well, then the gas piles up and at some point will leak into the cavity. And in fact, the situation is much more complex than this. But this was just, you know, a very toy model to just give an idea why, you know, opening a cavity in a disk would allow you to, you know, shrink a binary, because you're giving angular momentum to hold the gas there.
Okay.
So as we were saying, the reality is much more complex than that. And in fact, you know, the cavity doesn't hold the gas there at all. There's a lot of streams going on, and you know, there's a lot of interaction going on. And the interaction between a binary and a circumbinary disk is still today an open problem, because you know the parameter space is huge. You can vary binary mass ratio. The physical conditions of the disk are different. And it turns out that whether the binary gives angular momentum to the disk or receives angular momentum from the disk, it's a fine balance, it's a fine torque balance that depends on the physical condition of the disk. And in fact, there is still now no consensus no clear consensus on whether interaction with a circumbinary disk would actually shrink or expand the binary. So this is a very interesting area of current research. This, by the way, was the slide of the first slide of a discussion session that we had in Santa Barbara actually this spring about this problem, that is an open problem. And here is just a list of interesting in spiral versus a spiral, depending on the Mach number, disk aspect ratio, all stuff that people are investigating that might lead to different outcomes in the in spiral versus out spiral business. So, you know, as I said, we understand more or less stars, gas, not so much. And well, what if everything fails, right? What if the central density of star is not enough to make the binary shrink efficiently? Gas doesn't work. Well, you can still rely on triple interaction. In fact, this is just a collection of pictures from HST, and you see that there's a lot of multiplets of galaxies. And in fact, two galaxies merge, and at some point, you know, a third galaxy would merge with the remnant, right, of the first merger. And if there were two massive black holes that are, you know, at some subparsec separation holding there, a third black hole might get in, and then you will form massive black hole triplets. And massive black hole triplets are very interesting because, you know, there are things such as Kozai oscillation that happen. And here you have a stalled binary that is there doing nothing. A third black hole is coming in. It excites this Kozai oscillation up to the point where the inner binary becomes so eccentric that it merges because of gravitational wave emission. Or you can have very chaotic interaction with a lot of, you know, dynamical exchanges, and in the process you might get one of the three black holes, a binary to merge. So we did some, this is work that we did with a former PhD student here at in Milan. And essentially when you have a stalled binary, so this is the fraction of mergers that you can induce by taking a third black hole as a function of the inner and outer mass ratio of the binary. So now, forget the details, but the main idea is that triplets essentially can prompt the merger of pre-existing binaries in about 30% of the cases. So even if there is a last parsec problem and the black holes do not merge, the incoming of a third black hole will actually prompt the merger of some of these binaries, which is, you know, good for gravitational wave observations. So as I said, you know, these process of, you know, binaries shrinking and so moving in the center and forming a binary and then emitting gravitational wave is a very, very, you know, complicated one. The dynamical friction process itself, it's much more complicated because the background is not smooth. There can be a lot of stochasticity related to the clumpy matter distribution in galaxy. Here, you know, we have this problem related to gas that might exert positive torques and stuff like that. But one question might be, do we see massive black hole binaries? And the answer is maybe yes and no, right? So it depends a lot on the scales, right? And here I just want to flash these 30 seconds. So you have separation from several kiloparsec down to zero. And you know, at large separation, we see double quasars, so far so good. But you go as you go closer and closer in separation, it becomes much, much harder to demonstrate the existence of black hole binaries. So the best candidate that we have, well, the best, let's say, established binary, the closest established binary that we have is this double radio core that was published originally by Rodriguez et al. 2006, where these two flat radio cores are two black holes at the projected separation of seven parsec. If you go at smaller separation, then you have to rely on variability, time variability, or spectral signatures. But the problem here is that, you know, those signatures are generally not unique to binaries, right? So they can be contaminated by a lot of other stuff that AGN do. Because the real problem here is that we do not have a predictive model for the spectrum of an active dielectric nucleus, okay? And so when you don't have a predictive model for the emission of a single object, probing that there are two objects in there becomes, of course, complicated. And that's where gravitational wave come into play, right? Because of course, if these objects get to subparsec separation and can merge, they will be the loudest gravitational wave signals in the universe. And they will be picked by the laser interferometer space antenna LISA. So let me tell you a little bit about this. By the way, Juan, how long am I supposed to talk?
Yeah, well, you have 20 minutes, so.
Okay, so that's more than enough. So first of all, well, I guess at the Strong Gravity Institute, I don't have to do any order of magnitude calculation and explain why more massive black holes emit at lower frequencies. So I will assume that you will know this. So this is the landscape of black hole binaries. And you see here, I presume you're all very familiar with this type of plots. We have LIGO Virgo here at high frequency, and LISA sits here in the Milliers regime, where really is sensitive to black holes. To be fair, at all masses, right? Even to stellar mass black hole, but most importantly for us, to intermediate and massive black holes from thousand solar masses, perhaps to several millions of solar masses. Now, LISA, of course, is the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna, which is ESA, a European Space Agency-led mission that will be likely launched around the mid-30s. And it features a triangular configuration trailing the Earth, orbiting around the Sun. This is the sensitivity curve of the expected sensitivity curve of the instrument with the plethora of signals that we expect to detect. And of course, the most prominent and what are expected to have the highest SNR are massive black hole binaries. So this is one of the most compelling plots about LISA, and really, actually, it doesn't give LISA justice because it was for a design. The current design is actually more sensitive than this, but it gives you the idea on how LISA will essentially see any massive black hole from few thousand to several million solar masses in the universe, right? Because you see what happened here? Okay. Why did it go back? Okay. Because you see here in this mass range, you go all the way up to, redshift 20. This is the contour of SNR equal 10, right? So this plot, by the way, this shows SNR signal to noise ratio contours for massive black hole with this mass at this redshift, okay? So for example, if you have a million solar mass black hole at redshift 20, okay, you see it with a signal to noise ratio of 50 or something. Okay, so this is pretty, pretty impressive. And of course, as you all know, gravitational wave detectors are omnidirectional. So really you see everything in the universe. So these are tracks of synthetic tracks, of course, of evolution of massive black holes. So you see what I mentioned before, right? These are seed black holes that form at redshift 20. They grow via accretion, and then each dot here is a merger, Okay, so this might be a typical million solar mass black hole in a Milky Way like galaxy. This red here is going to be a typical quasar at redshift 2, and those might be the, you know, highest redshift quasar that we see at redshift 6 or 7. So whatever massive black hole you pick, you know, along their history, they cut through the Lisa band. And most, perhaps besides the lowest mass at higher redshift, most mergers that they experience, they're going to be picked up by Lisa. So this is why Lisa is an extraordinary instrument for probing the massive black hole cosmic history. And then, well, what Lisa will give us? Well, Lisa will give us likely hundreds of detections. So of course, this might not be that amusing, because now we already have 90 detections with LIGO and Virgo of stellar mass objects, but you have to consider that we can see all massive black hole binary merger in the universe, but massive black hole binary mergers are a much rarer event, right? So if you do like a back of the envelope pen and paper calculation, you might expect 10 to 100 of such mergers happening everywhere in the universe per year, okay? So assuming a 4-year mission operation, you might see hundreds of these systems. You can localize them in the sky, and I will tell a little bit about that. And then you can determine their parameters with exquisite and extraordinary accuracy, in particular, well, their masses and their spins, okay? So let me just skip through this and let me spend a minute on this slide. So this slide is it's a fairly old exercise. This is something that we did like 11 years ago now, but not much has been done after that on the subject, really. But this is going to be one of the most important thing, astrophysically speaking, that we will do with LISA. Of course, you want to detect gravitational waves from massive black hole binaries. You want to characterize these binaries, but you also want to understand their overall population property and, you know, pin down the physics that led to their formation and evolution. So here we try to do a very simple exercise where we try to see whether LISA can help disentangling different formation routes for massive black hole binaries. And what we did here, we considered several models for massive black hole binary seed formation, where we change the seeding mechanism. So we have this heavy versus light seed. We change some physics related to the metallicity feedback that essentially leads to different masses for the seed black hole in the ice seed formation scenario. We use different accretion efficiency and accretion geometry to grow the black hole mass. So we add a set of different models. And then what we did, we simulated LISA observations on a subset of systems from one of the model. And I handed this observation to a colleague, and I told this colleague, okay, find the parent model. And those plots here, essentially tells you how separable are pairs of models, okay? So roughly speaking, if this is a straight line that goes like this, okay, the two models are equivalent. And if the two models are distinguishable, then this line will collapse in the corner here, okay? Now you might say, well, I mean, those things look a little bit halfway true. But in order to make this diagram visible, we had to simulate 3 months of observation, and we have really 5-6 observations. If we simulate years of observation and we have 100 detection, essentially all these curves collapse in the corner there, and you won't see really anything because the models that we use are perfectly separable. Of course, this is a very idealized exercise because the universe is not, I mean, we're not going to test universe A versus universe B, right, with LISA. But what we will have to do in the future is to use informed model from simulation of seed formation, simulation of cosmic growth of structure, semi-analytic model, dark matter merger tree, so on and so forth, to construct a parametric model for the massive black hole binary population So that observation with LISA will help to constrain the key parameters that are related to the evolution of these massive black holes, which might be parameters defining the shape of the mass function or the redshift distribution of the seeds and so on and so forth. So it's really cool to see that, you know, this is something that we have like 10, 15 years to prepare at this framework, right, to interpret LISA data. But on an astrophysical perspective, I think this is going to be one of the most interesting things that we will do with LISA for massive black hole binaries. Okay, let me just spend a couple of minutes talking about, of course, the multi-messenger perspective. So one interesting thing would be to see massive black hole binaries in conjunction with, you know, in gravitational waves and in conjunction with the gravitational, with electromagnetic observations, right? Electromagnetic signature. Now, the idea here is that, you know, you have a binary. This binary is accreting gas. And since the binary, because of the binary period, right, this accretion can be, might be periodic during the spiral. And in fact, there have been several simulations producing sort of variability in different bands during the spiral of a massive black hole binary. So the idea might be that as the binary spiral, you have periodic variability that might help you identify maybe a counterpart. Then close to merger, you might actually have a depletion of gas around the black hole because as the gravitational wave emission becomes efficient, the binary sort of decouples from the circumbinary disk. So the gas lags behind, so to say. And so you can have that, you know, the source, the electromagnetic emission dims a little bit. But then when after the merger, when there is no more quadrupolar potential to hold the gas up, you can have a replenishment of the disk and you can have a birth of a quasar and you can launch a jet and so on and so forth. All of these is very much uncharted territory. There's a lot of simulations, full GRMHD even, that try to delve into the dynamics of this and the observational signature of these systems. But still, I mean, the actual signature have to be understood. Of course, if we have some smoking gun, then we can try to work with LISA in synergy with other mission. And here I have a couple of examples. One is the Vera Rubin Observatory, LSST, and the other one is the Athena mission. So Athena is gonna be the next big X-ray observatory. And the nice thing about it is that it has a pretty wide field of view of the order of 0.4 square degrees. So, you know, it's big enough to point a LISA source, let's say, close to the merger. Whereas LSST, of course, has the very nice property of having like a 10 square degree field of view and can sky the sky very quickly. And you get a pretty deep exposure just already in 30 seconds of observation. So one idea to do multi-messenger astronomy with LISA might be the following, right? LISA starts to observe a signal. Then as the signal gets, as the two black hole gets closer and closer to merger, the signal builds up in the LISA detector and LISA can start to pinpoint the location of the source well enough that it can tell Athena or LSST where to point and see if they find a distinctive signature. So this is a chart that essentially show that for a specific source. So here I have a, you know, few hundred thousand solar mass binary pretty nearby, a redshift tree. Redshift 0.3. So you see this system would be in the LSST field of view already a month before merger. So really you can try to scan that region in the sky periodically as the binary proceeds in order to see whether there is any interesting variable source that matches the phasing of the gravitational wave. Whereas of course for Athena, the field of view is much smaller and really you can get to point the instrument only close to merger. But this, you know, these are the kind of, there is a lot of ongoing work about exploring possible synergies between LISA and other electromagnetic and other observatories in order to perform multi-messenger observation. And this is one of the main things that is ongoing within the LISA science group with the multi-messenger and multi-band work package, for example. All right, so why it's interesting to look at the gravitational waves and electromagnetic signals together? Well, of course, you can do a lot of interesting things if you have both messengers, right? Because you can do cosmology and cosmography. And with massive black holes, you can actually go at pretty high ratios. So you can use massive black holes as standard sirens to constrain cosmology at high redshifts. So for example, you can constrain the Hubble parameter as a function of redshift if you have enough sources, for example. And of course, you know, if you have electromagnetic signals, you can study accretion of massive black holes with known mass and spin, right? Because LISA will tell you the mass and the spin of the objects pretty accurately. And really, so this is going to be the detection of those type of system is really going to be a goldmine for, astrophysics in the future. All right, so I think I'm pretty much on time. This is more or less what I wanted you, what I want to tell you. And, you know, so supermassive black holes are cool. Supermassive black hole binaries are also pretty cool objects. There is a lot of stuff, even though, you know, both on observational point of the observational and the theoretical side, right? There has been a lot of work on these objects for decades now. There is really a lot to understand, especially about their dynamics and also about their possible electromagnetic emission close to merger. And that essentially will impact a lot what the kind of science that we can do with LISA. Of course, we expect LISA to observe these things everywhere in the universe. And we are really, really looking forward for this fantastic instrument to fly in 10, 15 years. So, I know that there are people there that are working on in the LISA consortium, and I hope more people will join this endeavor. And I think I leave it there, and I will take any question if there is any.
Okay. Thank you, Alberto, for the very nice talk. Any questions? Maybe I can start with one question.
Start.
Alberto, you mentioned that you expect during the mission time of LISA, let's say for 4 years, you expect to see 100 these massive black hole binary merger events. Like, how certain are you about this number? Like, is the error bar like factor 2 or factor 10 or factor 100? How well do we understand this?
I wish it was a factor of 2, but it's probably more a factor of 100. Certainly, we can build models that are, let's say, astrophysically reasonable, which produce couple of order of magnitude difference in merger rates. So that's the reality, which of course means that, you know, we don't have a predictive model for those merger rates. And there's a lot of physics that we don't still, you know, get. And so in general, let's say what we expect in the most pessimistic cases, we might expect, let's say, few events per year. Whereas, you know, if we are optimistic, we comfortably go into the hundreds, which is, you know, would be nice, of course. The major uncertainties in those predictions are, certainly the seeding mechanism, and not only the mass, but also the abundance of the seeds. For example, in the heavy seed formation scenario, the direct collapse black hole scenario, it is really not clear how rare or how frequent, you know, how abundant are these objects. And this might have a very strong impact on the merger rate. And the other thing that has been, included in the modeling properly, let's say only recently, are the delays related to all the dynamical journey that the two black holes have to do after a galaxy merger, right? Because in early models, you just, galaxies merge, the two black holes merge. even in the cosmological simulations, right, where you have kiloparsec resolution, the guarded black holes are teleported to the center and merge. And when you start to add realistic delays to the process, you know, the two black holes start to take, I don't know, a giga year to get to the center. A giga year is maybe not much now, but a giga year at redshift 6 is the age of the universe, right? So the proper inclusion of delays is one of the main focus now to get, you know, a better handle on these rates. And they can cause, you know, another order of magnitude fluctuation in the rates. So really, you know, those are so complex. The physics is so rich and so complex that it's really hard. It's really hard to get down to a, you know, precise prediction for those rates.
I see. I guess you at the beginning you sort of mentioned this pulsar timing arrangement, mm-hmm. right? Like we know they have claimed, I mean, like Canonograph or IBTA, they claim the measurement of some common noise. Can you, like, let's say, constrain some of your CD model, assuming that noise indeed comes from this massive black hole merger background or something like that?
So that's a very good point. Unfortunately, I would say the answer is no, because so for those of you that have been on the moon for the last 2 years, there is this common red signal that has been observed by several PTAs, and we don't know what is the origin of this signal, and we don't know what are the properties yet, because essentially we don't detect yet the special correlations that this signal should have if it was of gravitational wave origin. Now, if this signal turns out to be of a gravitational wave nature, then of course that the, you know, Occam's razor would tell you that, you know, the most likely thing that is going to be is a signal from a population of massive black hole binaries, because we expect them to be there and we expect them to produce a signal more or less at this level. So that would be good news, because then of course it means that massive black hole binaries do merge. Okay, they really overcome this last partial problem, they really merge together and we are all happy. Unfortunately, because of most of the mass growth of these massive black holes happened through efficient accretion of gas, essentially the origin, so that whatever happens at high redshift is easily washed out, right, in the growth process. So I can easily have two models that produce one, you know, three mergers per year, and the other 300 mergers per year, that actually have the very same signal in the pulsar timing band. And this is because pulsar timing arrays are mostly sensitive to very massive black holes at low redshift. And those are the ones that are more constrained by observation, because they're constrained by the black hole mass function at low redshift, the luminosity function of galaxies and quasars at low redshift, and this kind of stuff, right? So all the models, all the merger tree models that we use, they have to reproduce those observations, right? So they all land pretty much in a very comparable pulsar timing array signal level, but they can have order of magnitude difference in the merger rates in the LISA band. So, you know, PTA is going to be super interesting, and, you know, it's going to tell us hopefully that the massive black hole binaries merge. But unfortunately, I really doubt they will give useful constraints for LISA. Of course, in all of this, I'm assuming that this signal comes from massive black hole binaries, because I'm pretty sure there are people there that might argue that, you know, it can be whatever stochastic background from the early universe. And it won't be easy to distinguish between the two, at least at the beginning.
Okay, cool. I see Will has a question.
Yeah, thanks Alberto for the nice talk. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the multi-messenger aspect. like mm-hmm. in particular, like how many events we should think of as potentially having a multi-messenger counterpart, if that's going to be like a rare thing or like something that's going to happen for a lot of these. And also which instruments you think are the most promising for this? Because in addition to the ones you listed, I've also heard some people talk about maybe some like next generation, like VLBI thing, like the whatever next generation HT type thing or something too. I just wondering if you mm-hmm. thought about that.
Yeah. Okay. So the let's see. The first part of the question was.
Just like how many of the black hole mergers do you think might have a counterpart?
Okay. I mean that's not an easy question to answer, but in general, let's say I would expect most of the binaries that are loud in the LISA band to have an electromagnetic counterpart, and this is because LISA is mostly sensitive to low mass binaries and also at relatively high redshifts. And we know that galaxies, for example, galaxies that host black holes of 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6 solar masses, especially at redshift 1, 2, 3, so moving to higher redshifts, they are cold gas rich in general. So we expect there will be a lot of reservoir of gas around these two, these massive black holes when they merge together. So my expectation would be that actually most of these binaries would be bright when they reach the final, let's say, the final stages of the spiral and merger. Now, the problem is there are several problems here. So first of all, what bright means, right? Because, for example, if you have a 10 to the 5 black hole that is shining at Eddington at redshift 4, yes, it's bright, but you won't see it anyway with anything, okay? So that's one problem, okay? And the real problem, and the other problem, the other two problems are, as I mentioned, the non-uniqueness, let's say, of signatures or the lack of predictive models that we have at the moment. And, the relatively poor sky localization by LISA, because LISA is it's a cool instrument. It's a super nice instrument. But unfortunately, the sky localization is still, for most of the objects, is still rather poor for astronomical standards, okay? So we are talking about square degrees or perhaps, arc minutes. But even if you go down to arc minutes, of course, if, you have a system at redshift 2, redshift 3, there's going to be thousands and thousands of galaxies in the error box, let's say, of LISA. And therefore, distinguishing, finding a distinctive signature, finding the counterpart is gonna be hard also because of that. About the next generation VLBI, I think it's really it's really cool. And I read somewhere that they might have the resolution. Well, essentially, the angular resolution is such that you can see a binary. I mean, you have the angular resolution. You see a binary at 0.2 parsec separation everywhere in the universe, right? Which is pretty nice. So those are not going to be directly LISA sources because they're going to be precursors, right? Because they're still far from merger. But I think and of course, they have to be both radio bright to some extent in order to be discerned as binaries by VLBI. But really, if this works and they can manage to have a sample of those systems, that would be really, really informative for LISA, right? That would be probably more informative for LISA than a detection from PTA, because it's really probing systems that are gonna be LISA sources. So I think that's a very interesting prospect. I mean, I haven't looked much into it and I don't know much about it, but I think it's a cool thing.
Okay, thanks.
Cool. Any additional questions for Alberto? Well, if not, let's thank Alberto again for the very nice talk and discussions.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for listening.